So, okay, Harriet Tubman. Well, first thing I have to confess is I had not actually heard of Harriet Tubman, I'm afraid, until sometime last year when I saw this this Hollywood film called Harriet, about Harriet Tubman. And I've asked a few people, and I'm not. I think she's probably not so much of a household name in Britain. But in America, she's one of the most famous people in American history prior to the American Civil War, anyway. So, yeah. I don't know. Has everybody heard of her? Anybody heard of her? Joel, you have, by the sound of it. Mike?
Yeah. I used to get books on black history. There used to be a bookshop in London called the Harriet Tubman Bookshop.
Hmm.
So that's where I first heard her name, and I'm going back a long way.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Funny enough, there's a jazz trail at the moment called Harriet Tubman as well.
A jazz trail?
Trio.
Oh, trio, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I saw them last year, Band on the Wall, yeah. So, okay. Yeah, but they're American, so it's understandable why they call themselves Harriet Tubman.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
What about you, Mike? Have you come across her?
I'd heard the name, but I can't remember where I'd heard the name. And if someone asked me, what does she do? What she's known for? I wouldn't have known what to say at all. So it's only the name, really. So yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Well, what I'll do is I'll just fill you in on some basics about it, so that you can see why I've wanted to do this FAQ on her. So yeah, as I say, she's one of these incredibly famous people in America. She was an escaped slave turned abolitionist, and she went by the name of Moses, and she became a legendary conductor on the Underground Railroad. She freed more slaves than any other conductor on that railroad. Then she was an army scout and a spy. She helped John Brown plan his attack on Harper's Ferry. She led an armed attack on a plantation at the head of a squad of Union troops. And in later life, she became an activist for women's suffrage. So, as I say, she's really famous in America. She's got all sorts of national parks and schools and streets and monuments named after, including an asteroid.
Asteroid,
yeah. She was the first African American woman to ever appear on a postage stamp. That was in 1995. And this year, 2020, she was supposed to be replacing the slave owner Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. And she would have been the first African American woman ever to appear on paper currency in the States. And in fact, the first woman of any sort in 100 years until Donald Trump kicked the plan down the road to 2030, calling it, I quote, pure political correctness. Anyway, I'm not going to give you her whole life story, because you could easily get that from Wikipedia or any number of dozens of websites, or you could actually watch the film I watched. It's quite Hollywoodized, I think. And it's such an incredible story that I kept watching it thinking, that never happened. That couldn't have happened. She couldn't have done that. That's ridiculous. They're making us look like Wonder Woman. So then I kind of, after the film, I went and sort of checked it all up, and I found that bloody hell, it did happen. She did do it. So yeah, it didn't seem to be made up at all. So yeah, Harriet, pretty decent film. Just a few basics of how she started. She was born about the same time as, around about the same time, 200 years ago, this year, roughly, around about the same time as Karl Marx, although she had no actual birthday, no record of her birth, so it could have been 5 years either way. And far from being any kind of white European male political theorist, she was born a black female slave and grew up entirely illiterate. Add to that she got banged on the head by a heavy object thrown by a slave owner. And afterwards, she saw visions and heard voices and thought God was talking to her for the rest of her life, which is why some some people have compared her to Joan of Arc, although she didn't get burned at the stake. What I find quite amazing about her is just how much she had stacked against her, and her bravery and her ingenuity were just quite absolutely unbelievable. The story of her escape is, you know, itself quite incredible. She's the chances of escaping from a southern plantation and making it alive to a northern city were pretty tiny, even if you knew what you were doing. But hardly any escapee made it without getting killed or recaptured. But Araminta Ross, Minty Ross, she was completely uneducated. She was quite small. She was quite frail. She'd never been out of the slave estate in her life, and she had to walk 150 miles to Philadelphia in winter with no map, no food, and a slave owner posse in hot pursuit. It took her about 10 days to do it, and nobody knows what she lived on. Nobody knows how she hid from the posse for 10 days. But she got to Philadelphia, she made it into a free city, and then, as if that wasn't enough, she turned round and went straight back to the slave estate in Maryland, straight back again, to fetch her family, having decided that since she could do it, if she could do it for herself, she could do it for other people too. And she did it. And she got a load of her family out, took them to Philadelphia, and then she did it again. And then she did it again, and again, and again. And she kept fetching out a small group each time. She became very adept with guns. She carried drugs with her so that she could tranquilise the small children en route so they wouldn't squeal and give them away. She made sure she travelled only in winter when there was nobody out of doors. She arrived at each its slave estate on a Saturday night because Sunday was a general rest day and nobody would notice the absence of slaves until Monday morning. On top of that, she also usually stole the slave owner's horse so he couldn't pursue them. She went by the name of Moses, and this unidentified Moses name spread around the slave estates. And somehow, I don't know how, the slaves got wind of the a special way of messaging each other that she was on her way to an estate. They would sing songs that would be secret messages to tell slaves that she was on her way to pick them up. And she's credited with the origin of the song "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," amongst others. So the slaves used songs to, tell each other that she was coming. That's a pretty amazing story right there. But that's just the start. And I'm not going to go any further into her activities in the Civil War and afterwards because, you can always just look it up. It's amazing. It is amazing stuff. The more you read, the more incredible it becomes. And what's incredible it's incredible in the sense that it's really hard to understand what makes someone like that tick. I mean, obviously, she was undoubtedly very religious. That was a big driver. But then lots of slaves were religious. It was very common. If you saw that Tarantino film, Django Unchained, there's a really good bit in it where the slave owner says, he asks this key question about slaves. He says, "They outnumber us 100 to 1. Why don't they kill us?" Well, that's what I've always wondered as well. And not just about slaves in the Deep South, but in a way about the world's wage slaves. Why do the world's wage slaves put up with the wage slave owners? Slave owners have always been afraid of their slaves, and I think the ruling class are always afraid of the workers. The ancient Romans used to have a saying that, never mind the enemy across the sea, it's the enemy across the corridor you want to worry about. But in spite of that, the masters are usually safe and the slaves are usually docile. Well, why is that? What makes just a few people into rebels and the rest into Uncle Toms? I think Araminta Ross gives us a bit of a clue. In a word, experience. there seems to be quite a lot of agreement that what made her rebel was seeing her mother rebel. Her mother was also called Harriet, or Rit, whose own Ashanti mother had been shipped from Africa. Now, Harriet Senior had 9 children, and the slave owner sold 3 of them. But when he tried to sell off her youngest son, who was also called Moses, Rit hid him for a month, assisted by the other slaves. And finally, the slave owner sort of got fed up with this game of cat and mouse and came to grab the kid by force, at which point Rit threatened to split his head open. Now, you would think that there'd be no good ending to a story like this, but in fact, the slave owner backed off and abandoned the sale, gave it up. Now, this suggests something quite important for revolutionaries, it seems to me. You don't get your revolution out of books on political theory. You get it from direct experience. If you see others rebelling, you're more likely to rebel yourself. Minty's mother, quite amazing, I think, threatened to bash the slave owner's head in. So, you know, no wonder Minty grew up thinking she could take on the world. This is something worth remembering, I think, when we look at the modern world and we don't see much sign of revolution against capitalism, and we think, heaven help us that this SBGB is all there is. But, of course, it's not, and we're not. And, Harriet Tubman reminds us that, you know, we don't matter in a way, because as long as people have that experience, you know, the notion of revolt and revolution won't disappear. Harriet Tubman was the sort of intersectional mother load. She was black, she was female, she had special education needs in modern parlance, she probably had religious mania. If she was alive today, she'd probably be institutionalised. But if she could fight with so little going for her, it's a powerful message, I think, to people today, that anyone can fight. All they need is the experience of resistance, and the sight of it, you know, the awareness of it. And, we can do our part by showing our own resistance to capitalism. I think this is what makes us such a huge icon in America, with their kind of frontier spirit, almost a Republican frontier spirit. There's always been something quite deeply anti-state in America, which I think Harriet Tubman plays up to well. But there's also an element of the kind of socialist ethic in there as well that's really powerful. She really deserves to be better known in this country and in other countries as well. So there we are. That's my kind of quick summation. Why of Harriet Tubman. Any thoughts?
Yeah, thanks, Paddy. Sounds interesting. I might get a hold of the film to watch it.
Well, she's not really a socialist icon. She's not a feminist icon. She's not, I don't know what she is, but freedom icon, can we call her?
I mean, on the subject of... when you said learning from experience, from a mother being ill-treated, I mean, there are examples of that today throughout the world, isn't there, of sort of like families in under various regimes where the militia come in and kill families. But it doesn't always lead to those people wanting to sort of change things. I mean, it's access to other ideas than, I suppose, those people, what they want first is to survive and live in some sort of stability. I think that's one way of looking at it.
I think, what I meant was her experience, The crucial experience she had was not seeing her mother being ill-treated, but seeing her mother fight back.
Yeah, yeah.
That was what I was trying to get at.
Yeah. No, you're right. You did say that, yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, when you think about it, when, you know, sort of average kind of Western lifestyle, you go to work, maybe you go to the pub sometimes, you know, you see your friends. How often do you see any of them rebelling? You know, how often do you see anyone fighting back against the system? You know, people see it in, okay, you know, if they're in a strike situation, they see it. But, you know, that's a rarity. You know,
well, we've got it at the moment, haven't we, with the Black Lives Matter movement. But even, and you'll obviously notice yourself, it's certainly not getting the coverage in the newspapers as it did. I mean, you struggle now to find that much coverage in the newspapers on the Black Lives Matter movement at the moment.
I was watching BBC News and I had Click On and they were looking at things like Black Lives Matter and Amazon and Google and they were looking at what Amazon and Google sell. I mean, the head of Amazon supported Black Lives Matter, but yet they sell white supremacy flags and white supremacy medallions and things on Amazon. And Google was the same. So they're saying one thing and doing something else, really, which is a bit ridiculous. But at least the programme on the BBC News showed them up, really, you know. So I think everybody's getting on the bandwagon with Black Lives Matter. But Amazon, I mean, they're just giving lip service to it, really, you know, because they're selling white power flags and things like that.
Yeah, but Dougie, didn't you see that news report yesterday that they've agreed to stop selling all white supremacist stuff, and so has Google? That was yesterday in the news.
They agreed to stop selling?
Yeah, I just saw it on
today, and they were saying, you know, that they've been told that's what they were doing, and I think, yeah, have they stopped selling it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but think about it. I mean, the income they would have got from that would have been minimal, whereas the bad press they're getting for it would be global. So, of course, they've stopped selling it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't realize they stopped. I never said on the news today. Yeah.
But Joel's point about, yeah, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing, where's that a few weeks later? I think that's the short term attention deficit syndrome of the capitalist media, isn't it? You know, it feels it's done the subject to death now, and now it wants to, you know.
Well, I mean, it's up until a few weeks ago, I mean, I couldn't keep up with the amount of programmes relating to Africans, Afro-Caribbeans, etc. It was like there was either a documentary on a play or a discussion. I mean, it was like, he's looking through the schedules and you just couldn't keep up with it. But again, even that sort of tailed off. There's not as much of it. I mean, it's, and as we know, newspapers and various media are always looking for the next big story, aren't they? I mean, it's, doesn't matter what it is, if it's controversial, if it's something which is going to sell them lots of print or get viewing figures, that's what they're interested in.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like how the profit system works, isn't it? If, you know, if there's any profit in a particular line of production, capitalism will throw the kitchen sink at it today and then just discard it tomorrow as soon as it doesn't work anymore. And that's how the media works, isn't it? That's what we saw with the Black Lives Matter. You know, they went absolutely out of their way and threw everything they had at it and then got bored after a couple of weeks. And it's dropped out of the news.
I'm surprised that somebody hasn't copyrighted the Black Lives Matter movement sort of name and sort of...
I mean, somebody did try, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I heard about that. So yeah, somebody did try, but the obviously there's opposition to it. In fact, I think it was somebody from Manchester, wasn't it? That tried.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But it's quite striking. I mean, it's like, what's the next story going to... I mean, I suppose the latest story at the moment is the Uyghur Muslim, isn't it, as well? I mean, how they're being treated by the Chinese government.
Well, there again, I think the Western press doesn't go out of its way to annoy China. So yeah, we see the odd report, but yeah, not very much. And very little mention of Tibet and places like that.
No, I know. I mean, it's... well, they want to do business, don't they? I mean, it's that. They want the money. Yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, in the days of apartheid as well, I mean, it was only by concentrated efforts by people, and that they slowly started to sort of take their business interests away from South Africa. But I mean, that's because of concentrated efforts by people.
Well, I mean, it kind of amazes me. I mean, going back to you know, Harriet Tubman. You know, like I say, she's like incredibly famous in the States, you know, and they've got all kinds of roads and highways and, you know, things named after her. And like this was, you know, she was like born 200 years ago, and yet we're still seeing the kind of Black Lives Matter thing 200 years later. And okay, they haven't got slavery anymore, but yeah, even you would just think that things would be a bit further forward than they are, given that she's a sort of national icon to white people as well as black people, you know. I mean, just seems quite amazing.
Yeah, well, it's an example of how things haven't moved that far, and is it? I mean, it's they'll only give so many concessions, won't they? The sort of various governments, either in the US or around the world, they'll give so much, but I mean, I think with what's been happening in America, I mean, it is pointed, isn't it? I mean, it just shows you look at things and some of the things people are saying, and sometimes you think you're going back before pre-segregation at times.
Well, I think with the Black Lives Matter movement, there's been a lot of sort of high profile, you know, sort of, well, stunts is a bit sort of dismissive as a word, but, you know, sort of pulling down statues and and also things like, you know, sort of taking old TV programs off streaming services if, you know, if they've got outdated language and things in. So, you know, it's quite sort of easy to do sort of small individual acts like that. But of course, you know, where they're going to struggle. Same with the, you know, the Me Too movement, which, again, you know, you don't hear about that these days. You know, the structural change is the thing that they, you know, that they can't, you know, that they can't address, you know, using their methods and their sort of way of looking at things. So I suppose all they can do really are, you know, are things that, you know, do get a lot of publicity, and, you know, they do get the film crews and they do get posted on social media, you know, footage of a statue being pulled down or what have you. But anything more fundamental than that, you know, they can't really do. So maybe that's one reason why, you know, that these things tend to sort of burn brightly for a while, you know, because they do the easy stuff and then it just sort of, you know, sort of settles back down and you know, they think they've got a few little victories. And yeah, you know, some things are, you know, significant to some extent, but yeah, it doesn't sort of shake the foundations, does it?
Yeah, I think the frightening thing would be if there was to be hearing people say abolish the wages system and really criticise capitalism, this is what it's all about. That would be quite an interesting thing to see how governments would react to comments like that. But obviously people aren't saying that.
I mean, certain types of rebellion, you know, like Harriet Tubman and also, you know, to some extent, the Me Too movement. They're kind of, from capitalism's point of view, they're quite safe, really. So capitalism's quite happy to sort of embrace those kind of causes and assimilate them into itself. in a kind of, in a form of sort of virtue signalling. You know, in the case of Harriet Tubman, she can be a sort of national, international icon because, hey, we're not living in slavery anymore. Isn't that nice for you? It's nice capitalism where nobody's a slave. Well, not in theory anyway, nobody's a slave. And so that's perfectly safe. You know, that was nasty, bad old history, and we're not like that anymore. And with me too, it's sort of similar kind of thing, is that there's this, you know, hey, modern capitalism is nice, and it's, you know, it's we're all for equality with women and stuff, and we don't want to see these nasty powerful men do these nasty things, even in Hollywood. So they're kind of safe. So but when you hear people, you know, when it hears people say abolish the wages system, abolish capitalism, that's not at all safe. So you won't see that being mentioned in the news at all. That will continue to be out of the mainstream news until there is a sort of groundswell of support for it, which we don't know when we're going to see that.
Yeah, I mean going off the Harriet Tubman thing, I think Extinction Rebellion, I think at times the press found them, I suppose, humorous at times when they were sort of attaching themselves to sort of, or gluing themselves to sort of objects, and when they took over sort of like Deansgate in Manchester and place in London, I mean, I suppose he saw them as just like quaint hippies or something like that.
Yeah, they go in for that sort of theatricality, don't they? Dressing up in sort of costumes out of the Mask of the Red Death. They came to Lancaster one time and they were sort of, they were kind of walking around the middle of Market Square looking like a Hammer horror movie, and it was all quite creepy. it didn't make me want to go and talk to them. It made me want to avoid them, quite frankly.
Right, right.
You don't mean those V for Vendetta masks, do you? Or is there another mask that I hadn't heard of?
No, it was when they were wearing these little long red capes. It was like, it was from the Vincent Price film Mask of the Red Death, and you know, they were deliberately looking quite sort of grand guignol, and it creeps everybody out. But it's good media grabbing stuff. You know, it's the perfect stuff for, you know, media headlines, big splash photos and stuff like that. The anarchists tend to be quite good at this sort of thing. They're very kind of, I always think the anarchists are quite media savvy in a way that, you know, we never are. They think of, and you know, and our members will say, oh, it's just stunts, it's just, you know, political stunts that don't mean anything, and they are just stunts. But, you know, there's stunts that get attention. And I think one of our biggest problems as for us, our party, is we don't know how to get attention. We don't believe in stunts because we just think that that's something that people do who aren't serious, which I think is wrong.
I think this guy that's going to be talking from Australia, this sympathiser, I think he could have some interesting things for us to sort of look at in terms of using the media. And,
he might do, actually, because I was talking to him and I was saying, on your Facebook page, it says that your page is the most popular in Western Australia. And he said, no, I just put that in for a joke to wind up Facebook. He says, they hate me. They hate me. They keep trying to shut me down.
Right. Yeah.
I think, well, these days it's the, you know, it's the meme, isn't it? You know, that, I suppose that's sort of, well, you still get placards at demonstrations, but I suppose the thing to do, and yeah, hopefully that'll be covered, you know, in the discussion in a couple of weeks' time. You know, it's something, you know, sort of witty with a, you know, only a sentence or two and a snappy image. And once something like that goes viral, then, you know, then it, you know, it sort of gets retweeted, and also, you know, that's the way to get publicity these days, isn't it? And it's just finding that sort of holy grail, isn't it? You know, the slogan or the picture or what have you that that sort of captures people's imagination. And all of these memes, you know, use sort of wit and humour as well, which, again, sometimes that's something we don't quite...
Sadly lacking.
Yeah. But... Yeah, that's it, isn't it? It's all sort of memes these days. Whereas, you know, I suppose the SPGB is more from the tradition of, you know, handing out a leaflet with, you know, 1,000 words of wonkily photocopied text on. And although, well, no, I think that's being a bit unfair to us. You know, we don't do that quite so much these days. But yeah, I suppose we're used to handing out sort of text, aren't we? You know, something that's long enough to, you know, to sort of get the meat of our argument, whereas what we want is something that can be boiled down to a sentence. And yeah, you know, abolish the wages system. That's been a good enough slogan for however long. But yeah, it still sort of lacks something, doesn't it? You know, you need more than that with a meme these days.
I mean, I think podcasts and people on YouTube giving like 10-minute talk about things. I mean, I've seen quite a few on Facebook and things like that and YouTube, and some of them are very funny, and they hit home quite well, especially about the coronavirus and masks and things like that, really, you know. So some of the people that are talking are very funny, and then they seem to get thousands and thousands of hits or whatever, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, I've seen lots of funny stuff. People send me lots of funny stuff, and yeah, they will get attention, obviously, won't they? Because some of them are funny. Yeah, it's yeah. But yeah, I mean, going back to Harriet Tubman, I mean, I think over here in sort of like within the Black Lives Matter movement, she probably people wouldn't talk about within that. I mean, they probably talk of more recent sort of activists for civil rights and freedom than they would about Harriet Tubman.
Well, I think when partly one reason why she may not be so well known in this country, I think, is just is probably historical that you know, slavery wasn't long since done and dusted in Britain by the time she was, you know, becoming active. I mean, I think Britain abolished slavery in 1807, and whereas in America it didn't happen until, you know, 1865. So it was a burning issue in America for a lot longer than it was here, I think.
Yeah.
Something I was reading about Wilberforce was, you know, he's kind of famous as the sort of, you know, the British abolitionist, but he's quite a controversial figure because a lot of black activists have said, you know, he gets all the credit, whereas all the black activists at the time, you know, nobody knows who they were, and he's kind of, you know, he's the kind of upper class gentry white, respectable establishment figure, and he carries off all the kudos for putting through a reform that really was the work of black activists at the time. So I don't know, that's quite interesting. And that's, again, that's a contrast with, you know, Harriet Tubman, that she was most definitely, you know, the authentic article, as it were.
Yeah, I remember a party member telling many years about Wilberforce. I mean, he was talking about ending slavery in the US, but he had like the chimney sweeps, didn't he? Working, I mean, he wasn't the sort of, he was talking about freedom for people in other countries, but he'd have sort of like child labour in this country.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I remember reading that as well.
Yeah,
well, people sort of remember, you know, sort of the myth as much as anything. I mean, all the stuff, I mean, with Winston Churchill, you know, he's frequently hailed as, you know, the greatest ever Englishman, and all that business. And, you know, that Obviously, you know, hailed more so by the right. But, you know, if you ask lots of people, you know, bumped into them in the street, you know, who would you consider as the greatest living Englishman? You know, Winston Churchill's name will come up quite often. But of course, that sort of ignores, you know, his quite blatant racism and, you know, all his other downsides, which are maybe being sort of highlighted a bit more than they used to. But, you know, with all of these characters, you know, if they're in a position of power, they can also, or their followers can, you know, sort of downplay the sort of the negative aspects of them and hype up the more positive. So maybe that's why Wilberforce is quite well known, because he was in that sort of position of power where, and, you know, of course, with hindsight and nostalgia, you know, sometimes the you know, that the bad sides of their personalities get, you know, sort of swept under the carpet by their apologists or their followers. You know.
Also, there's a tendency to mythologize people that I think is I think human, you know, the human species is a sort of story creating animal. You know, we can't resist it. We storify everything. And you can see this with Harriet Tubman, actually, because the sort of mythologizing of her started in her own lifetime. The very first biography was written by a white intellectual woman, quite rich woman called Sarah Bradford, I think. And it was essentially a eulogy of Tubman, you know, just making her sound like Wonder Woman. And then a few decades later, somebody felt that this had to be corrected, so they went and wrote a biography of her where they portrayed her as a sort of boozing, sex-mad, swearing, you know, anti-heroine. Biography, I think, came out in the 1990s, which tried to sort of draw some kind of balance between these two things. So, you know, this process of mythologizing, I think, is a very strong tendency for humans.
Well, when you're talking about people like Wilberforce and Churchill, I mean, academics have to take sort of blame for that as well, because these certain academics will write these things, won't they, about these so-called great leaders and Englishmen or whatever country they come from. Some of the academics have a hand in writing all that stuff about them, which is not correct.
Yeah, also, but I mean, it comes back to this, you know, well, this thing I was saying about stories. You know, a story has to have a hero. Whereas the materialist view of history isn't about heroes, it's about, you know, social and economic forces and processes. It's intrinsically unromantic. It doesn't make for good stories the way the great man myth or the great woman myth does.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, you know, we remember the history we want to remember, and we shape it for our the needs of the time. You know, history is constantly being rewritten every generation. It's, you know, it's a process of constant revisionism, and yeah, you see that with Harriet Tubman. It's really quite stark. It stands out that different generations come at her from a different angle. There'll probably be another biography of her in the future, you know, coming at her from a different angle again.
Didn't Kanye West say something what was alleged as being negative about her?
I don't know, maybe. Don't know. What did he say?
I can't remember what it was. I read, because, you know, he's supposed to have bipolar now. And it was mentioned in an article about how he'd said something about her, but it didn't actually say what he'd said. And, yeah, it wasn't positive what he said about her.
Oh, I've just had a look for that on Google. Hang on, I'm just waiting for the page to load up about it. Hang on.
Apparently, yeah, he'd said something negative about it. But as I say, I mean, he now claims only in the last week or so that he's, or his family said he's got bipolar.
You found it, yeah?
Oh, my computer's going all slow. Oh, dear. Hang on. I don't know if it'll be worth the wait.
it might come up later, so you can bring it up later.
Well, that just kind of illustrates what I mean about the mythologizing, you know, but people can't resist sticking their two pennies in. And if there's a sort of received image of a historical character, you know, as a great saint or a great evil doer, you know, there'll always be some people who think, oh, you know, they want to just put the other point of view just to be controversial.
Yeah. Well, it's been said that Gandhi had some unpleasant views as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, and who is it did a famous takedown of Mother Teresa?
Oh, it was. He's got these. He's one of two brothers, isn't he? What are they called now? I know it's one of it. And there's two brothers, and
not the Hitchinses.
That's it. That's it. Christopher. It was Christopher.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But I mean, there's a documentary I saw just recently on V.S. Naipaul as well. And he had some unpleasant views, and he was about women and violence to women and some racist views as well. Yeah. Has it come up yet, the Kanye West thing?
Oh dear, my computer has gone all slow. God dear. It was something about her not really being a freed slave, or no, that was it. He said that she didn't free slaves; she just got them to work for a different slave master, or words to that effect. I don't know the context of that. The page hasn't loaded up properly.
Yeah, that's
still.
Yeah, that's what I heard that it said as well. Yeah. Well, he's a guy who wants to be president of America, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's trying to stand in the air. Couldn't do worse than Donald Trump, though, could you?
Well, all news is fake news to Donald.
Well, apparently, it says here that he compared himself to Harriet Tubman and Nat Turner, two Americans born into slavery. But then he said slavery was a choice.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You said that would be cool. Yeah.
But according to Huffington Post, there's no actual evidence that... No, it seems like he did say it. Slavery is a choice. Okay. Well, I suppose everything's a choice when you're a multimillionaire. Maybe it's easy to see the world as just a set of infinite choices.
He probably wouldn't have said that before he became a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
Probably not, yeah.
When he was making his way up, he probably wouldn't have said that.
Yeah, apparently he tweeted a fake quote from Harriet Tubman, something she supposedly said, but that apparently never did. So
yeah, I typed in before my computer decided to go all slower. I typed in Harriet Tubman quotes, because I wasn't sure if she'd sort of written anything down, her Wikipedia page said that she was, like, you know, a speaker on abolition, And I'm guessing, you know, she didn't sort of leave much in writing. The quotes attributed to her, that they're sort of inspirational things about, you know, sort of dream, following your dream, that kind of thing. But yeah, maybe one reason why she's not so well known these days is, yeah, she didn't sort of leave much in the way of stuff that's written down. So she hasn't sort of, obviously there was a sort of lived experience, but yeah, it didn't sort of translate into, you know, quotes or a book or a pamphlet or anything, which, I don't know if there's any transcripts of the talk she gave. I'm guessing not, but yeah, it's a shame she didn't sort of leave more writing, because then she might be better remembered.
Yeah, because people remember Frederick Douglass, don't they?
Who?
Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, he's the more famous anti-slaver abolitionist. I think that he was. He was also an escaped slave. I don't know whether she actually ever learned to read later in her life.
I mean, some of Douglass' quotes have been used in the Standard over the last sort of like year or so, haven't they? The odd quote here and there. So we're not sure whether she learnt to read or write in a machine.
Well, one thing I couldn't help noticing was it's kind of slightly sad but slightly funny in a way, is that there's a few monuments to her that quote. She did have one famous quote about how she'd ran all these, she ran the Underground Railway, and she never lost a passenger. But they always put that she never lost a passenger with a V. But actually, she spoke, when she said the word never, she pronounced it with a B, never. And yeah, she would say dem instead of them and that. But in the quotes on the monuments, they sort of they've corrected her speech, which some people have claimed was a bit patronising, and they should have quoted her in the original. But one monument did quote her in the original, with her original dialect, and everybody then complained that was racist. But it's kind of a way, I thought it was a way of sort of taking her kind of, you know, personality out of it. Cleaning her image up a bit. You know, that started, like I say, that started during her life.